Okay, Boker Tov, everybody, or Tzaraim Tov, Merav Tov, depending on where you are in the worldwide Beit Midrash, the Torah in Motion. It's a pleasure to see everybody, and it's a pleasure to welcome Dr. Menachem Kellner, to make his debut on Zoom Torah in Motion. We've had the pleasure of hosting him in Toronto quite a number of years ago, but now we'll have the opportunity to learn with him online. Dr. Kellner is the chair of the Department of Philosophy and Jewish Thought at Shalem College, and the Wilson Professor Emeritus of Jewish Thought at the University of Haifa. His most recent publication, which is really the origin of this class. I read the article and I said, okay, I've got to invite him to speak. That just appeared in the last issue of Tradition. Today's Perplexed, Between Maimonidean Promise and Peril, and really discussing the Tzelem Elohim of Jews, non-Jews, distinctions between Jews and non-Jews, etc. This is actually part of his Hebrew book, Gam Heim Kruim Adam. They too are called people, are called humans, Gentiles in the eyes of Maimonides. So it's a pleasure to welcome Dr. Kellner for what will be, a short three-part series. And Bakasha, I assume you are in Yerushalayim or in Haifa as we speak?
I'm in Haifa.
You're in Haifa. Okay, that's there we go. Okay, Bakasha. It's all yours.
Thank you very much. Well, good morning to you and good evening from me. I'm going to speak for about an hour, and then I'll be happy to try and take questions either from the chat box or directly from you live. And I'm going to speak about the following. Well, let me start with a few stories in order to explain what I want to talk about. The first story has to do with a niece of mine who was spending a year in Yerushalayim. Her husband was in one of the Haredi yeshivot. And I was invited over for dinner one night. It happened to be in Yerushalayim. This is before my days at Shalem. It's quite a while ago. And my niece's husband, a lovely man, came home from yeshiva and told a story he heard that day in the Beit Midrash. And the story was that a Catholic priest had met a young Jewish boy. And to make the long story short, managed to get this boy back on the derech, so he became frum and chazer b'tshuvah, and everybody was very happy. And so my niece was really impressed. You have to understand, she's a very sweet and very naive young woman, and mother of many by now, of course. And she said, wow, that priest must have earned a chelek b'olam haba, a share in the world to come. Then she looked very upset, and she said, but what will he do there all alone?
Oh, that's funny.
It's more sad than funny, but in any event, apparently in all of her very good Jewish education, she never learned that the Jewish tradition never thought that non-Jews could not earn a share in the world to come. That's just one of the many stories I could tell about the topic of today's discussion. One more. Out of the many, is a friend of mine, a rabbi in the Midwest of the United States, once had occasion to ask three Rosh Yeshiva at Yeshiva University, does God listen to the prayers of non-Jews? So one of the Rosh Yeshiva said, of course. A second says, of course not. And a third said, I have no idea and nor am I interested. So that's another explanation, perhaps an example of the kind of point I'm going to be talking about with you in today. I would say that in general, and I hope I'm not going to offend anybody or misrepresent the case, the vast majority of Jews who call themselves Orthodox today follow a strong and very firm tradition according to which Jews and Gentiles are very much not the same, that Jews are in some kind of serious ontological, metaphysical, spiritual fashion, different from Gentiles and superior to them. And in making this claim, this kind of position follows the views of Rabbi Yehuda Halevi in his book, The Kuzari, which is perhaps the most mild or moderate expression of this idea, because whereas Halevi definitely thought that Jews and Gentiles do not have the same possibilities. The Jews can reach heights of spirituality that Gentiles cannot, but he certainly thought that Gentiles were human beings. But there are texts in the Zohar, many texts in the Zohar. There are texts in Hasidic writings. There is a fairly standard view in what's called Haredi Judaism today. And I think much of modern Orthodox Judaism in North America, and certainly in much of what's called religious Zionism here in Israel, all of which think that the distinction between Jew and Gentile is basic. It's fundamental. It's something which cannot actually be overcome. Then, of course, the question is, what about conversion? And there are different excuses or answers given to that problem, but it's seen as a problem. What I want to talk about today is to argue on the basis of one text, namely Rambam's Mishneh Torah, that Rambam, agreeing with God, does not think there's any distinction, innate, inherent, metaphysical, spiritual, ontological distinction between Jews and Gentiles. In other words, Rambam takes seriously the notion, which the Torah says in the book of Genesis, Sefer Bereishit, that human beings are all made in the image of God. That is something Rambam takes very, very seriously. And it's a view which very often arouses amazement on the part of Jews who've had the benefit, shall we say, of a normal Orthodox Jewish education, when they discovered that there is someone as important as the Rambam who does not think that Jews are in any sense different from innately and superior to non-Jews. Now, the way I plan to go about this is not by quoting from Rambam's Guide to the Perplexed, his more purely philosophical work, because that would make the job too easy. Instead, I want to just choose for our three sessions three distinct texts taken out of Rambam's Mishneh Torah, his Code of Jewish Law. In fact, what I plan to do, and I think Maxine sent these texts to you, but I'll provide them each time, is take the very first paragraph in the Mishneh Torah, that's for tonight. Take the very middle paragraph, that's for next week, and the final paragraph, that's in 2 weeks from now, in order to argue the point that even out of Rambam's allegedly purely halachic work, Mishneh Torah, one can realize his view that Jews and Gentiles are all created in the image of God. Now, of course, there's a lot more to be said about this subject, and one has to admit the Rambam was a tremendous elitist. So the fact that human beings were all created in the image of God does not mean that all human beings, Jews and or Gentiles, get to where people are supposed to go or get to, or one should hope one would get to, i.e. a share in the world to come. But what distinguishes membership in the world to come is not being Jewish or not being Jewish. What gets you in, so to speak, is what you do with what you're given. In other words, how you live your life and how you perfect yourself in ways that Rambam thought were important. Now, I want to make a preliminary comment, and I'm not going to prove the point. I'm just going to state it. Is there any clear text in the Tanakh, in the Torah, which says there is some kind of clear, innate distinction between Jew and Gentile? And I think the answer is clearly no. Now, Yehuda Levi, when he was just developing his idea of the special nature of the Jewish people, thought he was interpreting the Torah, but he was interpreting the Torah like we all do, very much from his perspective, and picking out particular aspects of the story in Sefer Bereishit in Genesis, and emphasizing certain aspects and de-emphasizing others, but there is nowhere in the Torah, anything which even comes close to the position that he developed, that from day one, i.e. from creation, a special, shall we say, in effect, race, even though he wasn't a racist in modern terms, I should emphasize that, a special race was caused and developed by God, which eventuated in the creation of the Jewish people. I don't think you can find a single verse, a single pasuk in the Torah, which supports that. One could perhaps find in Sefer Ezra indications in that direction, but even there, it's totally not clear. But that would be, to my mind, the only possible exception. How about in rabbinic writing, text of Chazal? And there, the question is, the issue is more complex. And there you have people whom certainly give the impression that they think there is an innate difference between Jew and Gentile. But you have at the same time, many passages in rabbinic writings which make it clear that no one there, or the people who authored those particular passages, did not see any innate difference between Jew and Gentile. And the same question can be asked about the liturgy and the prayers, the tefillot. Is there any clear-cut vision of a distinction between Jew and Gentile, and it's very hard to find any. If you pay attention next time you're in a synagogue or a temple and you follow the liturgy carefully, then look for passages in the liturgy which seem to emphasize that Jews are not beloved of God. That's clear. You chose us from all nations and loved us. No one would deny that that's part of the Jewish teaching. But the question is, why? Does this choice reflect some kind of antecedent, objective, superior nature of Jews, in modern terms of Jewish genes? And if you read the text of the liturgy carefully, you'll see it's very hard to find anything of that nature. Okay, that's the first point, just by way of introduction. Now I want to get to the Mishneh Torah, Rambam's halachic work. I'm going to spend quite a few minutes talking about the nature of that work. It's hard for me to know what you know and don't know. So I'm going to assume that everybody knows nothing and explain what I think needs to be explaining. And those of you who already know all this, I apologize. You can put me on mute and go to sleep for a while. The Mishneh Torah is one of the few books written by Rambam in Hebrew. Almost everything else he wrote was in Judeo-Arabic. That means Arabic and Hebrew letters, with a lot, just like Yiddish. Yiddish is German and Hebrew letters, a lot of Hebrew thrown in. Judeo-Arabic is Arabic in Hebrew letters with a lot of Hebrew intermixed in it. But it's definitely a different language. It's not Hebrew, and it's not even pure Arabic. It's a language of its own, which scholars call Judeo-Arabic. Anyway, the Rambam wrote all of his works except for the Mishneh Torah in Hebrew, in Judeo-Arabic. The Mishneh Torah he wrote in Hebrew, probably because he wasn't writing for the Jews in his cultural sphere, but he's writing for Jews all over the world and for all time. And was sure that a language which Jews would always read would be Hebrew, as opposed to Judeo-Arabic, which he had no reason to think would be the language that Jews would speak forevermore. He could probably think of the following terms. The Torah is in Hebrew, and we all read the Torah. The Mishnah is in Hebrew, we all read the Mishnah. The Gemara, the two Gemaras, are already in our two versions of Aramaic, but Jews kept reading the Torah and the Mishnah. And so, Rambam took as his model Yehuda Nasi, Judah the patriarch, who was the editor of the Mishnah, and he wanted to write a work that was based upon or influenced by or was modeled on the Mishnah, and therefore that he also chose to write it in Hebrew. He even tells us he chose to write it in Mishnaic Hebrew. It's not the Hebrew of the Torah, it's the Hebrew of the Mishnah, and it's extraordinarily clear. Over the years, I've translated, I think, three books from medieval Hebrew into English, two for the Yale Judaica series and one for the Litman Library. And there's simply no comparison. They were books by Abravanel, Yitzchak Abravanel, and by Rabbi Leib ben Gershon, the Ralbag, and by the Rambam. The Rambam's Hebrew is clear. You will never have a doubt as to what he's trying to say. Whereas Ralbag simply loved ambiguous antecedents, and Abravanel was apparently getting paid per word, because he kept going and going and going and going. It was very hard to know where sentences begin and where they end. Whereas when Rambam wrote Hebrew, it was so clear that nowadays, let's say any one of you want to get a good, clear picture of the medieval pre-Copernican view of the nature of the structure of our what we call our solar system, what they called the universe. One of the best places to look is the first four chapters of the Mishneh Torah, because it is laid out there in an extraordinarily clear fashion. You don't need to be a specialist in medieval astronomy or medieval physics or medieval metaphysics, or you don't need to be a specialist in medieval Hebrew. If you can read a prayer book, a Siddur, you can read the Torah, you can read the Mishneh Torah and get a really good picture of what medieval thought the world we lived in looked like. In any event, the Mishneh Torah is a set of work. In Hebrew, it's divided into 14 volumes. Now, many people, when the book appeared, were blown away, as we say, by its brilliance, by its comprehensiveness, but didn't like the title. Mishneh Torah, after all, basically means summary of the Torah. It's the rabbinic term for Sefer Dvarim, the book of Deuteronomy. And so, almost from the get-go, Jews treated the book with tremendous respect, but refused to call it by the name Rambam gave it. But they gave it a very complimentary name anyway. Those of you who've been been exposed to the yeshiva world will have heard of a book called Yad HaZakah. Yad HaZakah literally means the strong hand. It's the strong hand by which God took the Jewish people out of the land of Egypt. So to call a book Yad HaZakah is not exactly an insult. And also, why Yad? Why hand? Because Yad in Hebrew is spelled Yud Dalid. Yud Dalid is 10 and 4, it's 14. And because the book is divided into 14 volumes, therefore the term Yad HaZakah makes a tremendous amount of sense for a complementary name for the book. So the book is divided into 14 volumes. The first volume is called Sefer HaMada. Now, Mada in modern Hebrew means science. Rambam never heard of the word science. He didn't know anything about he knew about what we would call science, but it was called something else in his day. When he calls this book Sefer HaMada, he didn't mean what we call science. He meant that which a Jew must know in order to fulfill the commandments and the rest of the Mishneh Torah. The Sefer HaMada itself is divided into five sections. And the first of those five sections is called Hilchot Yisodei HaTorah. And in a few minutes, we're going to, if I ever stop talking, we'll get to the first paragraph in Hilchot Yisodei HaTorah and spend much of our evening, in effect, unpacking that one paragraph. Now, the Hilchot Yisodei HaTorah is, like the rest of the book, a revolutionary text. We'll get to the specific revolutionary aspects of Hilchot Yisodei HaTorah, but first I want to talk about the revolutionary aspects of the Mishneh Torah as a whole. It is the first code of Jewish law which is comprehensive, including everything, including things Rambam knew weren't applicable in his day, like laws concerning how to build the temple, the Beit HaMikdash, laws how to bring korbanot, sacrifices, laws concerning the coming of the days of the Messiah, etc. So its comprehensiveness is, I think, never been followed, never been. I don't think any other Jewish code of law has come close to being as comprehensive as the Rambam's Mishneh Torah. If you think in terms of Shulchan Aruch, there are vast areas of Jewish practice which we don't practice today, and which therefore the Mechaber of Yosef Karo did not include in the Shulchan Aruch. So it's comprehensive. It's revolutionary in the sense that it was never done before. And it became a model for all subsequent attempts to write codes of Jewish law, including the Torah and the most famous of them all, the Shulchan Aruch. I would like to say, and I think I'm right about this, that without the example of the Rambam, who would have had the courage to write another code of law like Shulchan Aruch? I think that's one of the many ways that Rambam's influence changed Judaism in all kinds of ways, which we're not going to go into this evening. A second way in which the Mishneh Torah is unusual, unprecedented and not followed for sure, is its systematic, almost axiomatic nature. The Mishneh Torah is constructed in such a fashion that you can find anything you want to find. It comes to the table of contents. Everything is laid out in a very clear fashion. It's almost axiomatic, like Euclid's Elements. And that's why it begins with Hilchot Yisodei HaTorah. You could say the Yisodei HaTorah, the foundations of the Torah, or the axioms of the Torah. I like to tell my students that Mishneh Torah is a work of Jewish content, but written in a Greek fashion, systematic, axiomatic, whereas the Mor Nebuchim is a book of Greek content, philosophy, presented in a Jewish fashion, midrashic, and full of explanations of the Psukei Torah, verses in the Torah. That maybe, I think it's a fairly useful way of presenting these two books, but it's certainly true of the Mishneh Torah. It is systematic, it is axiomatic, almost geometrical in its presentation. In that sense, you can call it Greek, but the content is, of course, halakha, so it's hardly Greek content. Another aspect of the Mishneh Torah, which is worth pointing out, is that it is apodictic, i.e., it simply makes statements about what the law is, doesn't say why Rambam decided the law as he did, doesn't justify his decisions. It is a law code, which was part of the idea. He got into a lot of trouble. Many people criticized him for that. And in fact, many of the commentaries written on the Mishneh Torah pay him the compliment of trying to find his sources. And that's been a project that has kept Jews busy now for over 800 years, finding the sources of the Rambam's decisions in the Mishneh Torah. I just want to say parenthetically a word I like. you know, in medieval chivalry, a knight had a horse, had armor, had a lance, had a sword, had a shield, had whatever he had, and he had someone to schlep those things. A page, right? Or a page, I think they were called. Now, in medieval Hebrew, the people who schlepped the knight's accoutrement, his weapons and all, was called nosei kelim. The term comes from the Torah, actually. I like the idea that the people who wrote commentaries on the Mishneh Torah, and there are scores, not hundreds of them, are called among the Jews nosei kelim shel Rambam, the Rambam's weapons bearers or something. That's a very typical kind of Jewish thing. The medieval non-Jews had weapons bearers who were carrying weapons. The Jewish medieval Jews had weapons bearers who were commenting on the Mishneh Torah. So I'm not charging you anything extra for that nice little point, but I like it a lot. In any event, so the text was, as I said, apodictic. In other words, it just laid out what the law, it's a code of law, as it was at Rambam meant it to be. With no discussion as to why he got to the decisions he got to. The last point I want to make about the revolutionary nature of the Mishneh Torah is that the Mishneh Torah includes science and philosophy. You'll not find that in any subsequent code of Jewish law, not in Shulchan Aruch, not in the Torah, not in Shulchan Aruch Harav, not in Aruch HaShulchan. In fact, the Mishneh Torah begins with four chapters of science and philosophy. And at the end of each of the 14 volumes, the Rambam presents what you might call a sermon or a sermonette. The last paragraph of each of the 14 volumes is an effective statement of what I take to be, and not just me, I'll explain that in a moment, an attempt to say, well, what's the point of all this? What's the upshot? And there we see many times expressions of his philosophical views being woven into the Mishneh Torah. In fact, a friend of mine, a former student, and I wrote a book on each of these 14 sermons, sermonettes, concluding paragraphs. It's called Maimonides, the Universalist, the Ethical Horizons of Mishneh Torah, something like that. But it is 14 chapters, long chapters. We had a lot to say. Each chapter was about a final paragraph of the Mishneh Torah. So I certainly think that aside from the first four chapters, which we'll be talking about in a few minutes, Rambam wrote a halachic work which gave expression to many aspects of his philosophical take on the world and his philosophical take on Judaism. And the fact that my co-author and I, David Gillis and I, called the book Maimonides the Universalist, says a lot about what we think is the philosophical bent, you might say, of the Mishneh Torah in particular and of Rambam's writings in general. Okay, so that is all by way of introduction. Now we're going to see if I can actually succeed in using share screen to put up on the screen the text I want to use with you tonight. So we will find out in a moment. I've been teaching a lot by Zoom recently, so it usually works pretty well. Okay. Do you guys see a page of text with full of colors? Just give me a thumbs up if you see it, okay?
You see, I'm so pleased. I would just make it, if you can make it a little bit wider and bigger.
Okay. What I presented here are four texts, which will, I think, keep us busy for the rest of the evening, I hope. And the first is the opening sentence in the Mishneh Torah. The second is a little piece taken from the introduction of the first Hebrew translation of the Guide of the Perplexed by Rabbi Shmuel ben Tibbon. And the third is a text which relates to the first text, the Rambam's text. I wanted to see if anybody was really clever, because you see what I'm marking off here? That's an acronym for somebody who wrote a book called Rosh Hamanah. And this somebody was born in 1437 and died in 1508. Born in Portugal, was expelled from Spain in 1492, died in Venice in 1508. Any guesses who that might be? The reason I'm doing this is because I'm a Pasconiak.
Rabbanu.
But the first time I came across this acronym, it took me hours to figure out what it was. I just wanted to share it with you. Harav Don Yitzchak Abravanel. Smile. Okay. So we have here a passage from Abravanel's book of Jewish dogma called Rosh Amana, in which he explains the nature of our first sentence there in ways with which I agree. In other words, I can rely upon Abravanel to justify the interpretation I'm about to give you, even though I'm absolutely, even without him, I'm convinced that my interpretation is correct. I hope to convince you as well. And the last thing is to show you the influence of the linguistic nature of the linguistic ideas of the first four words here shows up even in a book by Rabbi Moshe Chaim Lutzata, the Ramchal. It's the very first sentence in his famous ethical / Kabbalistic text, Mesilat Yesharim, where we clearly see the influence of Rambam's language in ways in which Rambam would have 16 heart attacks had he been exposed to them. Okay, so that's what these texts are for tonight, and now I want to go back to the top. So as I said, Mishneh Torah opens with Sefer HaMadah. Sefer HaMadah opens with Hilchot Yisodei HaTorah, have 10 chapters. And the first chapter, which is first chapter in the of Sefer HaMadah, and therefore the first chapter of the entire Mishneh Torah, reads as follows. And I'm saving you a lot of trouble by having certain letters in red. The text reads as follows. Yesod ha-yesodot, v'yamud ha-chochmot, leida, she'esham, matsui rishon. V'umamsi kol nimsa, v'chol nimsaim mishamayim ba'aretz v'mashe b'nehem, lo nimsu ela me'amitati matso. In English. The foundation of all foundations and the pillar of all the sciences is to know that there is a prime existent and that this prime existent gives existence to everything which exists. And all existing things from the heaven to the earth and what is between heaven and earth would not exist except for the truth or the nature of the prime existence. Now, no one's going to say that's a
good, thank you,
piece of writing, because the word, the shorish mem tzadi aleph, existence, shows up too many times, okay, in too many different meanings. Now we're going to spend several minutes unpacking this sentence. Okay, those of you who see the hint that Rambam gives in the first four words, give me a thumbs up. Nobody else? Come on. What are the first four letters of the... okay, thank you, madam.
Good cave
of cave. Ilana, okay. Now your name shows up. The first letters of the first four words spell out the tetragrammaton, God's name. Okay? Now, why is Rambam doing this? I'll tell you why. It's because he knows that Menachem Kellner has a beloved younger brother in Lakewood, who would be horrified were he, God forbid, exposed to what I'm about to say. So Rambam is giving my younger brother, the rabbi, father of 15, the grandfather of God knows how many, and the great-grandfather of Lord knows. I'm sure he doesn't know himself because he'd be afraid to count, right? Yayin hara business. In any event, Rambam, what is Rambam telling us here with these the first four letters of the first four words? He's telling us he's from. My text starts out with a hint to God's name. In the Hebrew language, Hebrew slang, he's saying, I'm a dos, like you guys who are reading it. Don't worry about it. Now he makes it even stronger because he uses language, the music of which sounds so familiar to the ears and eyes of a person who studied Torah. Yesod ha-yesodot, the amud ha-chochmot, the foundation of all foundations, the pillar of all the sciences, Sounds like Shira Shirin, Malchei HaMelachim, Eidan HaEidanim, dozens, not dozens, but quite a few times, this kind of two-word expression occurs in the Torah. So the Rambam is making somebody like my kid brother comfortable with this text, so that he will ignore what the text actually says, because it sounds so Jewish. Now, this is a kind of literary trick the Rambam uses all the time. Now, I want to be fair. My brother will admit, by the way, my brother is a really good guy. I mean, he practices the Judaism not far from the one I practice. But it's not precisely the Judaism that I'm going to be teaching you about tonight. In any event, my brother would say, of course Rambam is writing ambivalently. He's writing so that my beloved older brother in Haifa will think he understands him. So we both agree the Rambam is writing for different audiences. The difference between us is that I'm the correct audience and my brother is the one he's trying to fool, whereas my brother is convinced that he's the correct audience and I'm the one the Rambam is trying to fool. You can decide yourselves which Rambam you prefer. I always tell my students that that's one of the ways in which Rambam has been kind to those of us who come after him. By making sure that you can read much of what he wrote in different ways. And in fact, he tells us at the beginning of the Mishneh Torah, the Mara Nebuchim, the Guide to the Perplexed, that the book is esoteric. There are secret doctrines taught there. Well, he has provided an income for people like me for 800 years, writing books and articles, what the Rambam really meant. So those of us in my profession are very grateful to him for keeping us. It's not the world's greatest income. You know, we're not hedge fund managers. But Baruch Hashem, we're comfortable. In any event, so what is the Rambam telling us here? He's saying, Yesod HaYesodot, the foundation of all foundations, the Amud HaChochmot, and the pillar of Chochmot. I said before sciences, and Abravanel will agree with me. Now, there are a large number of new things in these four words. First is, he's telling us that Judaism has Yesodot. Now, why are you not surprised to hear that? Foundations, I'm sorry. How do you say that in Arabic? Anybody know? Give me the name of an organization you've all heard of, which calls itself in Arabic, the base, the foundation.
Al-Qaeda.
Did I tell you?
Al-Qaeda.
The foundations spoken up here are a Hebrew translation. We know this from his Arabic works. Of the same work that Al-Qaeda called itself, the base or the foundation. So the first thing we learn here in this sentence is that Judaism has foundations. Now, one of the disabilities of not being able to talk to you back and forth is I can't ask you, why is that not surprising? Okay, I have to tell you why it's not surprising. Because this is the Rambam of the Mishneh Torah. I think Asher knows the answer. I judge from your face. This is the Rambam of the Mishneh Torah, whose previous important work was called Perush HaMishnayot, Commentary on the Mishnah. And in the Mishnah, there is a tractate called Sanhedrin. In Sanhedrin, there is a 10th chapter, and it's called Perek Chelek, at least in the Mishnah, where it's the 11th chapter. And the Rambam wrote a long introduction to that chapter. We're not going to go into that's a whole different story. And at the end of that long introduction, he lists 13 foundations of Judaism, the very famous 13 principles of faith, or Gimel Ikarim, which are a chidush, innovation of the Rambam. But since he already made that innovation, we know that the Rambam feels that Judaism has a basis of 13 views, which are such that anyone who holds them is considered Jewish and has a share in the world, who holds them, I should say, correctly, okay? So when the Rambam starts off by telling us that Judaism has Yesodot, those of us who've already been exposed to the commentary on the Mishnah aren't surprised. But here we have something else. We have the claim that among those Yesodot, among those foundations, there's one that's even more foundational. Okay. And so that we start off by saying that Judaism has foundations, i.e. principles, i.e. Dogmas, and I don't have time tonight to go into the whole question of what he means by dogma, but he means dogma. among these, there's one that's more foundational than the others, a yesod of the yesodot. And now I'm going to interpret, and later on I'll show you that Rav Hillel agrees with my interpretation. So the foundation of all these foundations is equivalent to the pillar of all the sciences, i.e. the axiom of all the sciences. And what is this most foundational view or principle or belief in Judaism? Now we get to the next word. It is Leda, which is Mishneic Hebrew for to know. So Judaism has a foundational principle, a foundational Kawayid, foundational Al-Qaeda, and it is equivalent to the axiom of all the sciences, and that which is both the foundation of the Torah and the axiom of the sciences, to know something. Not to believe in something, but to know something. Now, Rambam, like every Aristotelian since the days of Aristotle, would tell you that to know something means to know it with its causes, i.e. to be able to explain why it is so. Aristotle spoke of four causes. We're not going to go into that tonight. But to know something is to be able to explain why it's true. It's not simply to accept it because your teachers taught you. You have to have been able to prove it to yourself and others. And what is this thing that we have to know? Sheyesh sham. Now, this is a problematic expression because it makes no sense in Hebrew. There is there. We'll talk about this in a moment. And what is this principle of all principles, which is equivalent to the highest or the greatest, deepest foundation or axiom of the highest level of all the sciences? Is Sheyesh sham, which we will translate here correctly as there is, Matsui Rishon, a prime existent. Okay. Now again, my beloved younger brother, when I call him that, I'm not kidding. He is a lovely person. Wrong in so many ways, but a lovely, lovely person. Reads this sentence and says, okay, so the Rambam is speaking in a kind of philosophical language that Judaism has important beliefs, we all know that, and then among these there is something laid down. Now, he would not make the difference between to know and to believe. He would, I'm sure, say, you know, you're supposed to believe things, like the what he would call the Yud Gimel Ikrim, the Ikarim, the Ikarei Emunah. And what is it? So someone explained to him, Sheyesh sham means there is. And we'll talk about that in a second. And what is there? Matsui Rishon. So he would say, okay, that's another word for Kodesh Baruch Hu, for Devish, right? Well, we all know that's not the case. How many of you make brachot in the morning when you have a meal, okay? Baruch atah matsui rishon elokeinu melech ha'olam. Anybody who makes a bracha like that, please give me a thumbs up. Nobody, okay. This is, we're not going to go into it now, but this is clearly a philosophical language. In fact, we can, scholars greater than I have shown the sources of this in the writings of people like Al-Farabi, the great Arab logician and philosopher who influenced the Rambam a lot. Okay, so what is this foundational belief? It's to know there exists a prime existent, and this prime existent is responsible for the existence of everything else. And without the existence of this prime existent, nothing else could exist. Now, I'm not about to go into the following point. I'm just throwing it out to you. I can, if you're interested, you can write to me. I can send you places to read about it. Aristotle, whose God was very much not the activist God of the Bible, would be comfortable with this. Rambam here is not talking about creation. He's talking about providing a ground of existence. That's just because I'm a nudnik. It's not important for our purposes tonight. It's true, but it's really not important. Okay, so I want to go back now to the justify what I've been saying. First, with respect to the term Sheyesh sham. Now, I'm going to read you a fairly long paragraph, and I'll translate it. This is from Shmuel Mendibone's Hebrew translation of the Guide to the Perplexed. He wrote an introduction to the translation, big part of which is explaining why he had to create so many words in Hebrew. And the reason for that is fairly straightforward. Hebrew, which all of us love is a language which was obviously richer than the vocabulary we find in the Torah, in the Tanakh. There are plenty of words that we knew the ancient Hebrews knew, but the closet, for example, or whatever, you know. There are a lot of words they had to have had which weren't mentioned in the Tanakh. So the language was richer than the vocabulary we have in the Tanakh. What is certainly the case is the language of the Tanakh and afterwards the halachot and the discussion that came after are very concrete. It's not a language given to abstract ideas. I don't want to say that there are none. Obviously there are, but there aren't a lot of them. It's also not a language in which the Jews found it necessary to frame theological ideas clearly. Let me give you an example, which I think will convince you that I'm not misleading you. Those of you who've read the Torah know that a message that goes through almost all of the books of the 24 books of the Tanakh is that God provides for humanity, for the world as a whole, that God guides people. God rewards the righteous and punishes the wicked. Now, there's a word for that idea in English. It's called providence. And there's a word for providence in Hebrew too, hashgacha. What many of you probably, and the root, shin gimel chet, is found in the Torah. What we don't have in the Torah is a word for providence. The idea clearly is there. But ancient and rabbinic Jews apparently never felt the need to talk about the idea. So along comes a man named Shmuel Ibn Tibon, who's writing, translating philosophical works into Hebrew. He has to make up words. So the Hebrew word we use for providence, he made up, hashgacha. And this is one of many, many examples. So that's why he had to explain why so much of the vocabulary in his Hebrew translation of the Moreh Nebuchim is consists of words that he created. And he provided a glossary at the end of his translation of all the new words. Now, he also explained that in some cases, the Hebrew which he used following the Rambam's Mishneh Torah is Hebrew, which makes no sense in classical Hebrew, but it in effect is an Arabism. And our expression up here in turquoise here, Sheyesham, he says is that it's an Arabism. Now, I love this fact. I love this fact for the following reason. If you were to hear me give this lecture in Hebrew, you would all say, this guy was not born and raised in Haifa. He comes from North America. After 40 years of teaching at Israeli institutions of higher learning, I have a tremendously thick American accent. Let me just parenthetically tell you a story about that. Many years ago, I was drafted into the Israeli army. It was a mistake on the army's part because they had nothing they could use me for. And when I came out, I went back to my job at the University of Haifa. And one of my colleagues said, how was it? I said, well, it was really very hard. I'm a middle-aged guy at the time. I was much fatter than I am now. But I'm really glad I went through it. And she said, why are you so happy about that? And I said, because now I feel so much more Israeli. She started laughing and laughing. I said, what's so funny? She said, you said that with such a thick American accent. Now, why am I telling you this? You deserve a break. But beyond that, one thing anybody who hears me lecture in Hebrew will know, not beyond my accent, is my thought processes are still in English. I think in English and speak in Hebrew. I think in English and write in Hebrew. This sentence up here shows us that Rambam thought in Arabic and wrote in Hebrew. That's why I like this sentence so much. Sheyesham, Ibn Tibon tells us here, is an Arabism. Because there's no easy way to say it in Hebrew. In English, you can say there is. There is a cat in the next room. There is a God. There is a concept of freedom. There's no way to say, even today, there's no real easy way to say that in Hebrew. And so we see here the Rambam taking an expression from Arabic and literally translating it literally into Hebrew, meaning what it meant in Arabic, because he had no way to say it in classical or Bishtaic or even medieval Hebrew. Let me quickly read to you what Shmuel says about that. Thus you have in Arabic in some issues words that are not found in Hebrew. For example, kimilat sham in Arabic, fam, shabaravi in Arabic, kishiyirsu hachamim lomar shiyesh balam davaro benimsa davar acher echad yomru. So when the sages want to say that something exists in the world, they say, shiyesh sham davar echad, there is such a thing, okay? Rumzim bimilat sham ela mitziut. The word sham there is an indication of existence. But the ein zeh nimsa b'lashon ivri, but you can't really say that in Hebrew. And all this, the Maimonides Rambam was influenced by the scholars who wrote in Arabic. Because the Hebrew doesn't have this kind of thing. And now he says something which is, you don't often get fine humor in medieval philosophical texts. And now presenting with you a joke you can use around the Sabbath table. He's talking about, until so much so, that some of the people in this land, Provence, where he lived, Yaduli Krototo thought to read it as follow. Thought they knew how to read this expression. Ah karuoto bitseire takatashin. But they read it as if there was a tseire, two horizontal dots, under the shin of sham, which turns it into shame, right? The heavy knew, and they understood it to mean kinui, a nickname for the Creator, may he be blessed. In other words, people were so unused to the Arabisms in the Rambam's writing, they said, okay, the foundation of all foundations and the pillar of all the sciences to know that God has a name which is Matsui Rishon. Okay, so that's one point I wanted to, I thought it was amusing. Okay, I'm amused. But it shows us that Rambam is struggling to write philosophical works in Hebrew. By the way, we also see here, this is no indication, this is no proof of it, but there are other ways to prove this. His native tongue was Arabic. And apparently throughout his life, look, he was an absolute master of Hebrew. As I said before, his Mishneh Torah is a paragon of clarity, of excellence. When you translate text of the Mishneh Torah, you very rarely have times where you don't know what he's trying to say. You may not always choose the right word, or maybe you'll rearrange sentences, but you know what the Rambam is trying to say because his Hebrew is pellucid, crystal clear. But even he was influenced in his thought patterns by his native tongue, just like I am with Hebrew, with English. Okay, now let's get back to my claim that Rambam is teaching us here that the Yesod HaYesodot, the Emunah HaChmot, is to know that there exists a first existent, and that Amud HaChmot means the pillar of all the sciences. And now we're going to show someone who agrees with me. I was so happy to find this, because then they could say, okay, don't blame me. I didn't make this up. Abravanel saw it before me. So he wrote a book about dogma called Rosh Amanah. And for the first 20-odd chapters, it's an attempt to defend Rambam's 13 principles from criticisms by Yosef Albo and Chastai Kreskes. If you're interested, I can recommend books and articles on the subject. But at the end of the book, he turns around to criticize the entire project. He doesn't like the idea of there being Ikarei Emunah, using in his Hebrew, because if you have something which is Ikar, literally root, then also there'll be something which is tefel, unnecessary. Ikar and tefel are two terms which come together. If you have ikarim, then you have things which are not ikarim. If you have things which are foundational, you have things which are not foundational. And Abravanel thought that there are 613 principles of Judaism, not 13. So the last two chapters are a critique of the entire project. In any event, he makes the following point. He's asking a question against Maimonides, which he will then answer later on. I suppose you all know why Abravanel is thought to have been the creator of more Epicursuit heresy than any other figure in medieval Judaism. In case you don't know, I'll tell you. He wrote commentaries on much of the Tanakh, and he wrote commentaries in the following fashion, following basically a scholastic approach. He would begin each section that he was going to explain by asking a series of questions. And then he would go into a long, involved answer for all the questions. Now, when does a Jew typically read a commentary on the Torah? Shabbos afternoon after Cholent. So for generations, Jews have read all the questions that Abravanel asked, but fallen asleep before they got to the answers. And therefore, he is known as the creator of more heresy than anybody else in the entire history of Judaism. In any event, here's one of the questions he asks. Lama b'sefer hamada, i.e. the text we're reading, katav harav, that's Maimonides, b'ikar harishon, he's already calling this the first principle. Why does he call it yisodi yisodot yomur ha-chokhmot? Why does he say it's the foundation of all foundations? Now, parenthetically, let me answer him right away and point out that for Maimonides, for Rambam, the first foundation is to know that God exists, which in Rambam's eyes is also the first mitzvah in the Torah, as in his Book of Commandments. It starts with that. And for Rambam, it's also the first of the Ten Commandments, which are more than ten, but it's the first of the Decalogue. So Rambam has good reason to think that there is such a thing. But Ravidel says, why say this is the most important? He should have said it's one of the foundations of Judaism, not the foundational foundation of Judaism. That reflects his whole antagonism to the notion of a limited list of dogmas in Judaism. Now, Rambam started the whole process with his 13, but afterwards, for several hundred years, a lot of Jews got involved with the whole thing. Kreskes had six, Albo had three. Everybody had their own list, but they all agreed with Rambam that there was a list of Ikarim. But then, more important, he asks as follows, Uma lanu ladat, why do we have to know, Ima Yesod HaZeh, this most important foundation of the Judaism, is the Amud, the pillar of the Chochmot HaNochriot, which literally means foreign or alien or Goyesha wisdom. And now, Abravanel, like almost everybody else in the rabbinic world, likes to interweave in his language verses or partial verses from the Torah or Mamari Chazal, passages from the Torah. In Hebrew, this is called Lashon Mishubetzet. I don't know how to say that in English. When you put a precious stone in a gold ring, that's Lishabetzoto. There's a word for it in English, which unfortunately I've forgotten for the moment. Again, if we had a two-way language, one of you would tell me what it is, but it's embedded. It's a more technical term. I often tell people that after 40 years of living in Israel, my Hebrew has long since stopped improving, but my English continues to deteriorate. So I am illiterate in two languages. And there is a word for this. Whatever it is, you can figure it out, I'm sure. Lashon Mishubetzet. And that's considered a stylistic mark of excellence. So Abravanel likes to do it. So like many other people in the Middle Ages, they will take parts of Psukim. So let me read it the way he meant it to be, the way he wrote it, okay? Uma lanu, why do we care, ladad, to know if this foundation is the pillar of the Chochmot HaNochriot, asher lo mibnei Yisrael hema, which are not Jewish. Now that's strong enough. He's telling us that up here, the Amud HaChochmot are the Chochmot which are not Jewish. That's why I translated them as sciences before. But it comes even stronger if we fill in the rest of the verse, which he didn't say. The whole verse says, it's from Malachim Aleph, 1 Kings chapter 9, verse 20. The whole verse says, Kol ha'am ha'notar min ha'emori ha'chiti ha'prizi ha'chivi va'yevusi. And all those who remain from the seven Canaanite nations, Asher lo mibnei Yisraelim, they are certainly not Jewish. So by using this half pasuk, he's emphasizing the point that he's really upset with what Rambam did here. Because up here, Rambam says Yisodi Yisodot is equivalent to, according to Abravanel and Menachem Kellner both, the pillar of all the sciences. And that really upsets Abravanel. First of all, I'm sure he thinks it's not true, but even if it is true, why do I have to know it? What does it do with the Mishneh Torah, Halachic Book? Now, what is the axiom of all the sciences according to... axiom is not exactly the right word here. The high point, the pinnacle, the peak of all the sciences, is the last discussion of Aristotle's metaphysics in which he proves the existence of God. Now, what Abravanel is pointing us in the direction is that Rambam's Judaism is based upon a belief in God, which is equivalent to the kind of God Aristotle proved. And that really upset Abravanel, and it would terribly upset my brother if, God forbid, he ever heard a lecture like this, because it means that the God of the Torah is the God of the philosophers. And then Rambam continues in the following five paragraphs to prove the existence of this Matsui Rishon on the basis of philosophical argumentation. And then he ends up, and this is paragraph one. In paragraph six, he says, "Vidiat davar zeh," and knowing this thing, mitzvat aseh. Now, the reason I'm making you guys crazy with all this is because what we have here is an indication that whatever it is that Torah teaches can be understood by, can be absorbed by, can be accepted by any human being. Rambam is not saying that Aristotle converted to Judaism. He's not saying that Aristotle learned his philosophy from the prophets, nothing like that. But what he's saying is that when Aristotle speaks the truth, he's not saying anything foreign to Judaism. And he's further indicating that you can arrive at knowledge of God's existence. And arriving at knowledge is a positive commandment. Yediat davar zeh mitzvat aseh. It's a positive commandment. It is the first commandment of the Ten Commandments. It's the first mitzvah, the commandment of the Sefer Mitzvot. It's the first paragraph in the Mishneh Torah. It is the Yesod. It is certainly the first of Maimonides' 13 principles of faith. None of this is something which a Gentile can't get to. In other words, the Torah doesn't teach things which are not accessible to all human beings. And this is a view which is not universally held, but mildly in Jewish sources. Okay. I'm supposed to finish in 3 minutes, so let me just briefly... Oh, pardon me. Down here, Reb Moshe Chaim Lutzatto opens his Mesilat Yesharim, which is a very non-Maimonidean work, with, and I've emphasized the letters, Yesod HaChasidut V'Shorash HaAvudah. The same little trick. Yud He Vav He. Okay? Now, I can't prove to you that Rambam was the first person to use it, but he's the first one I ever heard of using it. And there's very little doubt that Ramchal, Moshe Chaim Lutzatto, got it from the Rambam. Of course, the Judaism he presents in Mesilat Yesharim is very different than the Judaism presented by Rambam in Mishneh Torah, and certainly in the Guide of the Perplexed, the Maharal Devotion. So this is the first stage of my... By the way, I should tell you, the book on which this lecture is developed, is based. Jay mentioned it before. I don't know if you can see it. Gam Hem Kuyim Adam. This discussion on the first paragraph takes 145 pages. So there's a few more things to say about it that I haven't bothered you with tonight. So what I tried, pardon me, what I tried to tell you tonight is that the very first paragraph of the Mishneh Torah opens us up to the idea that whatever Judaism is, it's not some kind of esoteric doctrine that only people with, so to speak, a Jewish soul can understand. It is, in effect, this is something which will come out further as we go along, addressed to the whole world. One last point. There's a controversy among the Tanaim, the authorities of the Mishnah, over to whom was the Torah given. Rabbi Akiva and his followers say, Torah nitna Yisrael. Torah was given to the Jewish people. Rabbi Ishmael and his students say, Torah l'chol bayolam nitna. The Torah was given to all human beings. Rambam certainly follows in the views of Rabbi Ishmael, as will become clear in our subsequent events. Okay, I'm now going to stop share so I can get back to the... Okay. Hi, Asher. And now we'll see if there are any...
Yeah, you see the questions in the in the chat box?
Oh, you have to go up to the top here. Okay. You all can see these, right?
I'm sorry? The first question is really from Ellen at 11:38.
Okay.
How do we know the chokhmah?
Very good question. I see Jay talking, but I don't hear him. Are you talking to me, Jay?
Yes.
You're muted.
Do people hear me? Can people hear me?
We hear you. We hear you.
Okay.
Does everybody hear me?
Yes.
You all hear Jay?
Yes.
Yeah. I don't hear Jay. Oh, I don't know why. Damn it.
Now do you hear me?
Now I hear you. I'm sorry. That was my fault this time, not your fault.
Okay. Okay. I'm sorry. The first real question I see that I see is at 11:38 from Ellen. How do you know that chokhmah means science rather than wisdom? I assume that science would mean metaphysics and physics. So is wisdom subsumed in metaphysics? You can take it from there.
Yeah, sure. Thank you very much. First of all, Bravanel tells us that, so I can rely upon his authority, right? He says, what do we care about the chokhmot ha-nochriyot asher lo mibnei Yisrael hema? But Rambam tells us in quite a few places that Chazal mentioned what they call Maaseh Bereishit, the account of creation, the first two chapters of the Sefer Bereishit of Genesis, and Maaseh Merkavah, the first chapter and the 10th chapter of the book of Yechezkel, Ezekiel, and the 6th chapter of Sefer Yeshayahu, and they call that Maaseh Merkavah. When he's writing in Arabic, Rambam says that Maaseh, when the Chazal, the rabbi is talking about Maaseh Bereishit, the account of creation, they are talking about Al Ilm Al Tiba'i, which literally means the science of nature. But it is the typical standard Arabic translation of the Greek word physics. And when Rambam tells us that when Chazal talk about Maaseh Merkavah, the account of the chariot, the great mystical vision of the prophet Ezekiel, that, he says in his Arabic writings, is Al Ilm Al Ilahi. The divine science, ilm is science in medieval terms, not what we would call science. And al-ilm al-ilahi is the standard medieval Arabic translation of the Greek word metaphysics. So, and if you want, so you can find this in the introduction to the Guide of the Perplexed. You can find this in the introduction to the third part of the Guide of the Perplexed. You can find this without the Arabic in Mishneh Torah chapter 4, the very last, the end of chapter 2 and the end of chapter 4, 4:13, you'll find this idea. So it's quite clear that when Rambam is talking about chokhmot, he means physics and metaphysics. And now, unlike the Soviets who thought you could, with Lysenko, have a Jewish botany and Soviet botany, or the anti-Semites who said Freud's theories were Jewish science, no one believes in a Jewish physics or a Jewish metaphysics. Rambam certainly did not. So when he says that Chazal are talking about Maaseh Bereishit, Maaseh Merkavah, and he means to say they're talking about what the Greeks called physics and metaphysics, that's another expression of his idea that there's no such thing as, let me put it to you this, interrupting myself, I want to tell you briefly, a man who I consider to be the greatest Maimonidean of the 20th century was a Yemenite-born rabbi called Rav Yosef Kafach, Zichron Ol Yivracha, who is a rabbi, okay? My wife always likes to remind me, before I go teach about the Rambam, remember to tell your students he was also a rabbi, not just a philosopher. Rav Yosef Kafach was a rabbi. He was a member of the Beit Din HaGadol, the High Rabbinic Court in Jerusalem. Okay? But he was also a great, 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 great Maimonides scholar, and he translated a huge number of medieval Judeo-Arabic works into Hebrew. He also put out a huge edition of the Mishneh Torah. He was once asked, what does the Rambam think about Limudei Chol, secular studies? And Rav Kafach said, there's no such thing. If something teaches truth, it's not secular. And if it doesn't teach truth, it's not a science. So he had no problem with the notion that Rambam thought that Torah taught science in the kind of philosophical sense that was used in the Middle Ages. That's not to say where Rambam to arrive. That's why I keep emphasizing not science in the modern sense. Rambam, if he were alive among us today, I don't think he would say that that the Torah teaches advanced nuclear physics. Unlike a lot of people who like to make that claim now. Did I answer the question?
Okay, I think so. You'll hear if people can speak up. And I just, I'll go through it. There are not so many. Someone wants to know what's the best book in English, modern translation, with preferably with annotations.
Of what?
Of the guide. Of the guide.
Of the guide? There is no such thing. In other words, nowadays, the standard translation is that by Shlomo Pinnis, which was published at the University of Chicago in 1963. Pinnis was a great scholar. Not a great English stylist. Now, a new translation is coming out with a huge apparatus by Len Goodman and Philip Lieberman by Stanford University Press. It'll probably be a year or two till it appears. That will be a much more readable translation because English is the native language of the two translators. And they both know Arabic and they know philosophy. Pinnis always amazed me. He was a guy who forgot every day more than I will ever know. So I don't pretend to put myself on a par with him. But in his introduction to his translation of the Guide, a long introduction about the philosophical sources of the Guide of the Perplexed, he spoke of the Mishneh Torah, what we've been talking about all night, as an avocation. Like halakha was a hobby of the Rambam's. Which means to me that he totally misunderstood. No, the Rambam spent 10 full years writing the Mishneh Torah, as he tells us, day and night. And to call that an avocation is, to my mind, just totally miss the point. But there is no really, Alfred Ivry wrote an introduction to the guide, but it's actually an introduction to chosen chapters, and it's very aimed at philosophers, not at normal human beings. So it's hard to say. There are a million good books about the Rambam that introduce him. I would recommend, first of all, a book published by Moshe Halbertal called Maimonides, Princeton University Press. I think if you're going to read one book about the Rambam not written by me, that's the one.
Okay. And I guess somebody wants to know if they can email. I mean, we normally don't give out email addresses. If people want to email you, I can forward, unless you were happy for me to give out your email address.
If it's not abused, I'm happy to. I don't care. I get questions all the time. I'm a busy boy, but.
Okay. So I don't know. What's your email? I can put it in the chat box, maybe.
Okay. I mean, you have it. You've been writing me
back. I do have it. I know. I mean, you have to go and get it and put it back.
Okay, fine. Okay. Menachem.Kellner, Menachem.Kellner, Kellner, @gmail.com.
There you go. That's easy enough. Okay. Okay. Thank you very much. I think we covered them, unless anybody wants to chime in. But thank you very much. We look forward to next week. 2 p.m. I know there was a little confusion. We mistakenly had 1 p.m. on some places. So the talk with the interview, Mark Shapiro of Rafi Al-Mali from in Morocco. Rafi is, of course, the leader, the local tour, everything, and the Jewish tour person in Morocco. So Mark Shapiro will be discussing with him Jewish life in Morocco at 2 p.m. as we begin a 5-part series on Jewish communities around the world, places we visited in the past on our journeys through Jewish history. And please God, we'll be able to go in the future. So that's at 2 p.m. in 2 hours from now, a little less 2 hours, 8 o'clock tonight. Of course, Moshe Sokolow continues his series on the putting evolving of Tanakh. He's going through the Mefarshim now of Tanakh. Tomorrow, Malka Simkowitz at 10:30 a.m. on Jews of Ancient Egypt. Shuli Mishkan at 12, 8:30 our Parsha Shir Leir Sarna, my Shir 9 a.m. in the Friday morning on the Siddur, and Menachem Liebtag 11:15 on Sunday, and then Monday, of course, Islam with 11 o'clock, Lindsay Guhartz, Dr. Rabbi Lindsay Guhartz, and Mark Shapiro, The Rise of Reform and Traditional Response. And then Tuesday, Aaron Kohler continues his Purim Megillat Esther after his fascinating class yesterday. And then at 11 o'clock, after the 9:30 o'clock talk, Shira Danziger, Shira Rachel Sharansky Danziger is back for another series. She's been on, I guess, a break for a couple weeks. She's doing a 10-part series on the ins and outs of liberty, beginning Tuesday at 11, and then at 1, Alex Israel will continue his series. So, Dr. Kellner, we've got lots to keep you busy, lots to keep your friends busy, and we invite everybody, as always, please, please invite a friend. That's what we ask of you. We greatly appreciate and invite your friend to attend the class, and hopefully they'll come to one, and then they'll join and come to many more. Okay, everybody have a wonderful day, and thank you very much. We'll see you all soon. Okay, bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Laila Tov.